Okay, so hello again. Today I want to talk to you about inline assembly. Actually, in general, not just in Rust, but let me get to some background about that. So basically, I am among the persons who like some inline assembly in Rust, because I'm often doing relatively close to the metal programming and doing embedded. I'm at least interested in writing kernel code, so I think that's something that would be nice to have. And Rust does have inline assembly right now, but only on the nightly branch, and it's in a state that could never be stabilized de facto. Also, it's in a state very similar to what other compilers do, and people hate what other compilers do. So my hope is that we could do better, and this is sort of a survey talk of what do other people do, what could we borrow, what do we definitely not want to borrow, and what would be a decent design point for Rust be possibly, right? Okay, so sort of the rundown of this talk is going to be, first of all, why would you want inline assembly? Then a quick overview just about what is assembler in general. I know we have some very not low hardware guys here, which by the way also means if at any point you feel like you have a question or something, just ask. If possible, use the mic for the recording, but also just ask and I repeat it. Because I realize a lot of this stuff is possibly obvious to me, but not obvious to any of you. So I'm going to try to explain it, but if you have questions, just ask. So quick overview of what is assembler, just so we're all talking about the same thing. Quick overview of what I think design goals for this should be, like what is least common denominator that we should get to with the design. And then with that in mind, prior art. So what are other languages doing in terms of inline assembly? As I said, what can we borrow, what not? Then a quick rundown of what is in Rust right now. So the stuff that is in Nightly, or some of it actually even isn't yet in Nightly. And then a bit of a hopefully discussion with you guys about what should we do in the future. Also, what do I think what a decent design point would possibly be. Okay, so why? So this is the first why you always get if you tell anybody, I want inline assembler in Rust. Because Rust is supposed to be that super safe language, like no exec faults, no data erasers, no anything. So what the hell are you doing putting inline assembly in there? That's like super insecure, and why would you ever do that, right? So here's why. Sometimes you just need to get to that low level, right? And maybe let's start at the bottom. The Rust philosophy in general is be safe, but if necessary, have an unsafe escape hatch that you can rip in an unsafe block and make sure that what you're doing is actually safe, but provide that escape hatch if necessary. So what you can do with inline assembly is a lot of different things. You can get low-level control, particularly in like kernel or embedded space, you might want to have write access to config registers, or maybe some hardware can only really be accessed from assembly, right? Like DMAs, SPI interfaces, that kind of stuff. A lot of that is usually memory mapped, so you could potentially also write to certain addresses, but some things just aren't, and you need to go down to the assembly level to access it. You might want it for performance. If your compiler is not actually intelligent enough to optimize certain things, you might want to go back to assembly just to get the performance you need for a certain case. Maybe you're doing video playback, whatever, you want to use vector instructions, the compiler can't figure out that it can use them because of whatever circumstances in your problem, you might want to be able to drop down to that. Sometimes you need predictable timing. In embedded, you sometimes need predictable timing because maybe you're handwriting something that turns certain pins high and low, and you need to produce a certain clock or whatever. You want predictable timing in cryptography. Actually, you want usually constant timing, so that the timing does not depend on your input, so nobody could guess what you're encrypting from observing timings of your messages. So side-channel resilience. Also, usually better to do if you have access to the assembly. Even in assembly, hard to do, but that's a whole different problem. And lastly, to the point of why do you need inline assembly? Because you could write a separate assembly file, right, and link to that. Mostly convenience. In some cases, it's for performance because you have the immediate interaction because you're inline assembly and your actual code. But in many cases, you could write a separate assembly file, put that through an assembler, link that with the rest of your code, but it's inconvenient. You have that separate file, maybe that feels a bit alien to the rest of your code, and it's not just a function in the same file where it actually should be. You usually need to start writing in build.rs file and do some more interesting things with cargo than you usually would have to. So it's certainly a convenience feature too to have that available to you. Okay, so this assembler we're all talking about, right? What is that even? And I thought let's start out with some examples in case you have like never seen assembly. So assembly is, let's say, a textual description of what instructions run on your computer. And naturally, there are different dialects depending on what processor you're using. But rather unfortunately, there are even different dialects for the same processor occasionally. So what we're seeing here is the upper two are assembly for the x86 processor. One is in AT&T syntax, which is what the GNU assembler would expect. And the other is the syntax that Intel actually puts in all of their manuals and that some of the Microsoft assemblers accept, or at least something similar, that things like NASM and YASM accept. And also people seem to generally agree that the Intel syntax is much more readable than the AT&T syntax, but the AT&T syntax is way more straightforward to get access to if you're on a GNU system. So the basic format that you can see there is that you have an instruction name, also called a mnemonic, and then some operands, like usually listed up with commas in between them. And operands to those instructions are usually things like either numbers, so called immediates, because they're immediately encoded into the instruction, like you have a 5 and that 5 goes straight in there. And those have different ways to write them, like AT&T syntax writes it with the dollar sign in front of it. Intel syntax just writes a plain 5. ARM writes immediates with a hash sign in front of them. PowerPC also doesn't really put things in front of them. For registers, you also have different conventions. AT&T definitely wants you to put a person sign in front of everything that you think is a register. Intel just writes the plain register name. Also, something I want you to pay attention to because it's going to get relevant later is there are a lot of special characters in use here. Like you already saw, there's a dollar sign, there's a person sign, there are round braces, there's an exclamation mark, there are square braces, a hash sign, what else do we have? Plus, times, so many different things that could occur in just regular assembly, right? And we'll get to why that's important later. So this is hopefully what I've already covered. So it's a textual representation. You call the instruction names basically mnemonics. They don't map to one-to-one to actual CPU instructions. That might also depend on the operands that it has, but they are a mnemonic name for the instruction. And you have various operands, registers, immediates, sometimes labels, which resolve to an address in the code, and combinations thereof. Like something you see at the bottom of the x86 assembly is this is a way to address memory based on contents of registers and then multiply it by some immediates. Okay. So design goals, where do we actually want to be? And the list is not super long. Like it should be easy to use. Okay, that's what you usually want from any new feature, right? I think it should be portable, like personally. Meaning between platforms. So you wouldn't want to define something that really only works on x86, only works on AMD 64, only on ARM. You should have some way to have this work across architectures. Because defining it and then figuring out like, okay, now I have x86 covered and I want to do some embedded programming on my ARM or AVR processor and just not being able to could be rather annoying. In general, we would also want it to be portable between backends. Like the Rust compiler is right now LLVM based and there's one Rust compiler, but at least to me, it feels like the ultimate goal is that Rust is a language specification and there could be more than one implementation. People have already talked about porting parts of the actual main Rust compiler over Kriton to get faster compile times. Someone had started on a GCC based port of Rust. And would be a shame if we did something that super locked us to only being able to implement this on LLVM. I think that would be rather unfortunate. And that's something I've actually put a question mark behind is, it would be nice if this supported all instructions with all possible operand types on them. But it's actually, to me at least, an open question if that's at all possible, because you always need some knowledge in the compiler itself about the instructions for that to work, which means that for every new processor, basically, you'd have to change the compiler immediately. And I don't think that's particularly feasible. Questions so far? Okay, so some prior art. So let's look at what others do. D, noticeably, is also a rather modern programming language, systems programming language. What they did is they basically implemented in DSL, which goes into an ASM block, which just starts with ASM and then the actual DSL and curly braces. And they say this is standardized per CPU family. So every different CPU can have a completely different DSL in theory, though the only one that's currently available is actually x86 and AMD64, so the x86 processors, architectures, so to speak. They can be marked additional to as pure and no-throw, so you can actually make certain assertions about your assembly that the compiler otherwise won't figure out. You can say they are pure, so they have no side effects, they only do a calculation. You can say they won't throw an exception. So what does it actually look like in the case of x86 and AMD64, because that's the only one that actually has like a defined DSL right now. And what they've done is they have kept it pretty close to regular Intel syntax, so just what you would write for an Intel processor. Basically, changes are that registers always have to be uppercase named, mnemonics are always lowercase, and then you can refer to variables of the enclosing scope via name, or at least you can refer to them via name indexed by the base pointer, so your stack base pointer. Or if you're not writing naked code, so code that doesn't actually set up a stack, you can also refer to them just by the variable name. They allow many D expressions in assembly statements too, so you can do regular numeric calculations in your assembly statement and will first evaluate the D expression and then insert that into the assembly that we're going to generate. They use the dollar sign to represent the program counter, so the register that tells you at which point of the program you are. But interestingly enough, that is only supported for jumping between instructions. You cannot use it to refer to memory relatively to your program counter, which is something that you might want to do when writing so-called position-independent code, where the benefit is that it doesn't matter at which address in memory that code lies, which is nice to have for security because people can't depend on addresses of your code when they're writing exploits for it. Interestingly enough, they also don't support accessing the actual instruction pointer, so the RIP address register is not defined for AMD64, which would be another way to do that. There are some pseudo operations to get alignment to certain addresses, to define data in line, and also instruction prefixes. I'm not entirely sure why instruction prefixes are pseudo operations and not actual prefixes to the instruction. If you're writing a custom assembler anyway, that seems like something you should have been able to do, but you have to write them as proper separate instruction before the instruction you want to prefix by them. So some very, very simple examples for this. So this is just code that will increment the variable var by 5. And it's actually pretty straightforward. You define the variable, you write an ASM block, and you call to the add instruction. And you can use the variable name inline. And just to have shown it, you can do usual decalculations in there. So you can add 3 to 2, and then it will insert the result of that in the generator's assembly. Something a bit more complex to actually show some of the edge cases, get the size of the L1 cache. And since this is the first time I'm showing the code, I'm going to talk about it in more bit more detail for other versions. I'm going to glance over it, I guess. So the way to do that is basically the CPU ID instruction, which gets you a lot of different information about your CPU. And the information that it does get you actually depends on the current value of a register, the EAX register. And if you set it to 4, which is what the first line does, it gives you information about caches. And the ECX register specifies which cache level you want to get information about. So setting it to 0, which is what the XOR does, gives you information about the first level cache, right? And after calling the CPU ID instruction, the data that it returns to you will be in actually EAX, EBX, ECX, and EDX, so four separate registers. But what we care about is just an EBX and ECX. So we move that out to our predefined variables and then do some calculations to get the actual size. So all pretty straightforward. You didn't have to specify anything specific. You're basically writing assembly, and it just interacts very naturally with your program, so to speak. Any questions about D specifically, actually? Yes?
Are the D expressions you can use, they're always only compile time executed, or can you actually do runtime?
Good questions. So the question was, are those expressions that you can use always compile time executed, or can some of them be executed at runtime? I didn't try a lot of that. My guess would be that they probably also can be executed at runtime, because what I suspect that would end up doing, let's say it like that, is it would actually pull those expressions before the assembler block and then insert the return value of that into the block. So if that had side effects, they would just happen before your assembly. granted, that's actually surprising behavior, possibly. And I don't know if that is a behavior or if they've restricted it sufficiently. But that would be my guess about what they're doing. Might also be that it's only stuff that can be constant folded. Like, it's certainly accesses to struct members, access to arrays, and stuff like that all works. Okay. Anything else? Okay. So MSVC. So we're now in theory territory of the C and C++ language. This is a Microsoft Visual C compiler. And they're actually doing a very similar thing, so I've not put as many words in it. They have a DSL. It's also an ASM block. This time it's written with two underlines. That's actually C-specific to not clash with any other defines you might have, because two underlines is reserved for the compiler by the standard. And it's also only available for x86, not even AMD64, actually. Apparently for AMD64, they have a whole pile of intrinsic functions. But inline assembly is only really supported for x86. And particularly, as you're also saying, the instructions we support for that platform are only what you get on Pentium 4 and AMD Athlon processors. So nothing from later processors, I presume, at least. So this DSL is, to some extent, basically what's a Microsoft macro assembler accepts as input, just as expressions in those curly braces. And it allows some rather interesting things, like you can do jumps from your assembly code to C labels, and you can do jumps, or go-tos actually, from your C code to assembly labels, just restricting some of the upper and lower caseness of them. You can also freely call into C functions from your assembly without any fear of that affecting anything else, which is not usual, because calls into C functions, of course, change a lot of registers. So you'd have to take care of restoring them properly once returning from them, right? Also, you can use some C and C++. No, you can't use any C and C++ operators in your inline assembly. So unlike D, they've restricted that from happening. So some things they support from the MASM syntax, or they don't support. You can't do data definitions, also unlike D, which have special pseudo operations for that. You also can't do macros, which give the macro assembler its name, right? What you can do is you can do alignment. So you can align instructions to certain addresses, and you can do comments in line, which is kind of nice. From C and C++ elements, you also can use C comments, so you get plenty of comment syntax, actually. You can use any symbols that exist in C. So labels you've defined, as I said, you can also even jump to them. Function names, variable names can be used inline. You can use constants from the C. You can also use C macros, so your usual defines. So while you use MASM macros, you gain macros that exist in C. Also, in some cases, MASM accepts type names. And in that case, the type names that C defines are also accepted for them. So the same examples, and actually they also quite look the same. I think for this one, it's actually possibly the same code. And that might actually be a copy and paste error because there it's missing two underlines. For this one, it's a bit different. And I should probably say that because I don't readily have access to MSVC, I did not test those. I tested all of the other ones, including the D ones. Didn't test those, actually. But from the documentation, the way how that works is pretty much exactly the same. You have to call your variables different from your registers because you can't disambiguate between them otherwise. So you have to do this, in this case, underline V trick. But other than that, you fill your registers, you call CPU ID, and you move your register contents to your variables. Another smaller big difference, depending on how you look at it, is that instructions in the MSVC assembly are always terminated by a new line, which gives for some rather strange looking code, actually, because you can't even technically terminate them with a semicolon. I mean, you can, but if I recall correctly, that starts a comment, which in some cases is not what you want. So and after that, you do, in C++ this time, calculations, and it will give you the char size. Equally easy to use with some other idiosyncrasies, sort of. Any specific questions about that? Yes? Wait for the mic, maybe.
What about rescuing the registers used by the application around the assembly block?
Pardon?
Where does the compiler knows which registers are tainted by the assembly block?
Yes. So So the usually term, and we'll get to that basically over the next two or three slides, is which registers are clobbered, so which are used by the assembly. And yes, since this is a DSL and the compiler basically has full knowledge about what happens inside there, it knows and it will assign registers accordingly to variables and all that stuff.
See the side effect of the CPU ID instruction? Well, the register isn't explicitly mentioned in line number five.
Right. So CPU ID does clobber for registers technically, right? Because it has output EX, EBX, ECX, EDX. And that would have to be defined in this assembly implementation. Like, from what I'm understanding, is this is basically a full assembler written in your compiler to some extent. Based on what they're supporting and aren't supporting, probably borrowing heavily from MASM, but that's a guess. And they know about side effects, yes. As far as I can tell, both D and MSVC do, because otherwise it would just break down with every surrounding code, obviously, yeah. So this is also what makes it very, very nice to use, that you don't have to specify, oh yeah, by the way, these other two registers were also touched by that instruction, and you don't have to worry about that, basically, yeah. Okay, so still in C land, GCC. GCC also has an extension, a C extension for inline assembly. Maybe I should actually make that more clear. C does not itself standardize how inline assembly works. So if you can do inline assembly, it's an extension of the compiler. MSVC has one, GCC has a different one. And it's actually very different. Like, it's almost fair to say that those are the two different schools of it. Like, MSVC indeed do DSLs, while GCC also has some special syntax, like based on the fact how C usually looks for ASM, but it works completely different. So the way it works in GCC is that you have basically this function-y thing called ASM, and your first argument to it is an assembly template. So that will contain your assembly instructions with some placeholders for certain things that will get inserted in there later. And the template is not actually interpreted by the compiler, except for the placeholders. It will generate finished string, and that will be passed to an assembler. So the compiler itself, the C compiler, does not have to know about the instructions or anything. It just has to generate a string from what you gave it that will later work with the system's assembler. So the syntax you put in there will basically also have to end up being what your system assembler supports, which is in some way very nice, because that means if your CPU gains a new instruction and your system assembler is updated, that instruction will be supported as long as you can fill the placeholders correctly, which is the catch, actually. So what do these templates look like? They are basically usual instruction sequences, and the placeholders are dollars, percent sign for followed by number, or followed by angle braces and then a name in them. So you can use named parameters, sort of, and positional ones. You can use some modifiers. So if you say, I want to insert a register in there, but it should be a 16-bit instead of a 32-bit register, you can use the W modifier, for example, just in front of the number. It also supports some rather obscure features, like in cases like x86, where for the very same architecture, you have different dialects, AT&T and Intel syntax. You can write those different dialects next to each other, just wrapping them in curly braces and putting a bar between them. The catch about that is that you either just write the first supported one in the list, which is AT&T for GCC, for x86, or you have to specify all of them. So if there are, like, for some reason, five dialects for a CPU, you have to write all five dialects straight away and can't just choose the two super common ones or whatever. My guess is that also doesn't happen, but it's something to keep in mind. What that whole thing necessitates is, of course, that you have to escape all those special characters. So if you actually want a person sign in your assembly, you have to put two person signs in your template so it will escape and not be treated as a placeholder. Similarly, for curly braces and the bash character. So what do the arguments that are put into those placeholders actually look like? So you have to specify three things: outputs, inputs, and clubbers. So inputs are things that come from a register your assembly in some way reads and that, well, get used by it. Outputs are things that will go into a variable and that your assembly in some way writes. It is important for the way that GCC generates the code of that you only do those things with them. If you write an input, that could totally break your program. If you read an output, probably less bad things will happen, but they usually have just undefined values in them, so you don't want to do that. And third thing is clubbers, and we talked about clubbers before. So since the template is completely opaque to the compiler and it doesn't understand what those instructions actually do, it has to have knowledge of what registers were influenced by what the template did. So in clubbers, you basically specify, okay, this code touched these registers, and maybe it also touched memory that you don't know about, and maybe it touched some flags in the CPU and changed them that you don't know about. So that the compiler knows that it will have, for example, to reload memory, to save a register to memory before it executes the assembly block and load it back from memory after it executed it. So the value remains the same and all those things. And that's sort of what makes GCC-style assembly very difficult, because you have to keep in mind all side effects that all the instructions you just use have. And often, that's not as explicit. Like, you saw CPU ID has no operands whatsoever, but it affects four registers. Add has a one operand version that implicitly always writes to EAX and EDX. So those things can be very unobvious to you, and you have to manually specify them. So obviously you need to know a bit more about those parameters to fill the template. So you can't just say, okay, here's an input and that's going to be this variable. You also have to know, does it have to go in the register? Is this an instruction that supports a register as an operand? Is this a memory address? Is this an immediate? So what exactly needs to go in the template so that it will actually assemble? For that, you specify certain constraints on your operands. Those are usually in GCC just single letters, which makes it occasionally a bit hard to remember. Those letters are architecture specific, so they are different for x86, they're different for ARM. Though there are some that are common among all those assembly dialects, which are usually R, M, and I, which is just for a register, for memory location, and for an immediate. GCC also allows specifying multiple different constraints for the same operand. So if you have an instruction that can either take a register or a memory location, you can say, okay, my constraint is RM, and the compiler will choose what it thinks works better with the surrounding code. Right. So building even on that, there are some ways the constraints have to be specified. So output operands, even though they go in a certain location in the list, always have to start with either an equal sign or a plus sign. The equal sign means this is an output operand. The plus sign means this is an input and an output operand. Additionally, you can modify them with an ampersand character. And the reason to do that is there is a rule that you can only write to an output after you've read all of the inputs. The reason to do that, in turn, is that specifically on platforms that have only very few registers, you don't want to allocate too many registers to variables. So what the compiler will actually do is it will give the same register to an input and an output. So if you write to an output before reading all the inputs, you might just have overridden one of your inputs. In order to make sure that you can write to some operands early on, you have those syntax to specify this is an early clobber register. So it's overwritten earlier than you read all the inputs. And that's done with an ampersand sign. Inputs are usually just like that single letter character as a constraint. But you can also specify a number, which is a number referring to one of the output operands, which is saying, OK, for this operand, put it in the same location that you put this output. So in some sense, it's basically the very same thing that you can do with the plus notation. So say this is an input out an output. But it allows you to specify a different variable as the input that goes into the register and as the output that comes from the register. And clubbers, I've already talked about a bit. You can say which registers were used, which registers that the compiler doesn't already know about were used. Because obviously you can say, OK, I have an output and this output is a register. And the compiler can freely choose what register that is. So it knows which register it chose for that operand, but it doesn't know which registers you explicitly put into this assembly. So this is basically specify all registers that the compiler doesn't already know are clubbed. You can also say flags were modified. You can say memory was modified. Also in that case, that means memory that the compiler doesn't know about. So the compiler knows if it gave you a memory operand that referred to a variable and it was an output, it knows that memory has been written, right? But you can also generally say, yeah, I'm not telling you, but I'm writing some memory somewhere. And the compiler will know that after that assembly has executed, it will have to reload everything from memory that it currently holds in registers. There's also a volatile specifier. And volatile basically does two things. It disables code motion. So one of the nice things, let's say, that the way GCC assembly is built allows you to do is you know most to all side effects of the instructions. So you know exactly what was modified. Because you either have to specify in a clubber or the compiler itself determined that this was going to be something that was going to be modified. So you can do optimizations on this. People often claim that inline assembly, even though it is meant for performance improvements, disables optimizations. But in some way, the way GCC does it doesn't do that. Because since you know all the side effects, you can do code motion. So if you know that nothing is changing in the execution of that assembly across loop iterations or whatever, you can pull that assembly block out of the loop and just execute it once. Or if you know that the outputs of that assembly block are never going to be used for whatever reason, you can just optimize it away completely. But sometimes you don't want that. And in those cases, you declare the assembly as volatile. Cases where this is required are, for example, something like the WFI instruction on ARM. What it does is it waits for an interrupt. So waiting for an interrupt doesn't technically have any side effects. Like it pauses execution until an interrupt comes in from somewhere. But it doesn't write memory. It doesn't write a register. It has nothing you could actually tell the compiler changed, right? But you still definitely want it to execute because you want it to pause the execution to save energy, usually. So that's a case where you would specify volatile, so execute is always, even if you think it's completely unnecessary and would want to throw it away. So those are basically the same examples, just this time more complex because, hey, GCC assembly. you still declare a variable, and then you have asm blocks. And this is what those templates look like. And in this case, it's even kind of nice. Like, it's AT&T syntax, so I said everyone likes Intel. This is the reason why. You have those dollar signs in front of your immediates. But other than that, there's a person zero. That's one of those placeholders we talked about. And then at the end, there is a specification of an output operand in line two with a plus sign. So that says this is both an input and an output, meaning I chose a register, I read from the variable var into that register, I execute your instruction, and then I write from that register back to the variable, right? And as I've mentioned before, another way to do that is define both an input and an output with the same variable. So the line three defines an output to var, and then it defines an input which is tied by referring to the output operand by number. Also input from var. So those two lines do the very same thing, just with different notations, so to speak. At this point, any questions about this? Because I realize this is super complex, and people who have a lot of experience with that usually get fed up with it quickly. So I would not be surprised. OK. So I'm going to assume I've confused everyone sufficiently to that point. So we're still going to do the GATSI L1 cache example, because that's even more complex, right? So the assembly is still exactly the same. Just something you will notice is now we have those placeholders which start with the percent sign. And AT&T syntax wants all register names to start with a percent sign. So you get a lot, and really a lot, of those double percent signs in here. Which is kind of really unfortunate, right? Because if it was just one, it would treat that as an operand placeholder. So the only really point where we have a placeholder here is that person zero at the very end. And I've actually made this a bit more complex than it needs to be. So what I'm doing here is I'm specifying two output operands. If you remember, we want to get EBX and ECX out of that assembly somehow. And what I'm doing here is I'm saying, OK, for EBX, give me an output operand and read that from some register. Hey, you get to choose which one. And then what I'm doing within the assembly is I'm moving EBX to the register that the compiler chose. For ECX, something you can do, and actually I think we couldn't really do in D and MSVC before, is we can tell the compiler, hey, this variable, please tie that to the C register. So the whole C family, meaning CL, CX, ECX, RCX. So we can say equals C, meaning put this, get this from the C register and write it into the ECX variable, which does nothing else than write that MOF instruction for us, basically. And then we've talked about these clubbers. So the CPU ID instruction clubbers, EAX, EBX, ECX, EDX. Now, the compiler knows that it treats ECX as an output. So we don't have to specify ECX in that clubber list anymore. And actually, if we do, the compiler will complain and tell us, hey, your constraints are incompatible. You're asking me to never use ECX, but you're also asking me to use ECX as an output. And at that point, we do, let's say, the usual calculation. Is that more or less clear what's happening there? More or less. Yes?
You said that the C identifier specifies a particular register, right?
Yes.
Is there, not every register can be used for every operation. How is that specified?
Pardon?
Some registers have a different, so to speak, type, and they can be used only in a limited operations.
Okay, so not right. Not all instructions support using them with all registers. And basically, the way that works is that those constraints specify a certain register class. So if you say R, that means not any registers, but that means any general purpose register, right? So for C, that's very obvious. That's one specific register. So you have to make sure that this instruction works with that specific register. For R, you basically have to make sure that the instruction you're using this with works with any general purpose register. There's also, I think, for example, on x86, there's x, which will give you an SIMD register and stuff like that. And those are the parts that are very architecture specific. Right. Yeah. But R, for example, is always one of the general purpose registers on across architectures, basically. Anything else? Okay. Pop quiz, sort of. I've made a 3rd example for a GCC just to get a point across. So what this is meant to do is you have an input and output variable. The input is set to 3. And you want to, well, not really increment, I guess. You want to add 1 to the value of input and write that to out. So sort of to get into nothing of massive mode here, what this assembly does is it moves the value 1, so this is an immediate, right, into the first operand, specified via a placeholder. The first operand in this case is a register which is bound to the out variable. So it moves 1 to out, basically. And then it adds the second operand, argument, let's say, to that out variable. So naturally, since we had 1 in there, and then we added the value of the in variable, that should be the in variable plus 1, right? So is this correct assembly, inline assembly? Does that actually work? Who thinks it? Yeah.
As far as I remember, the add instruction cannot access both operands on memory, but I'm pretty unsure.
They're both registers.
Both registers, okay.
Because the constraint is R, right? So it's moved into a register, it's moved back out from the register after the assembly.
Binding it to memory will be done by the compiler afterwards.
Pardon?
The binding to the memory will be done by the compiler in the post-processing.
Right, so either if those variables are even in memory, because the compiler could allocate variables in registers naturally, there will be a MUF instruction from the register back to memory after the assembly is executed, yes. So inside the assembly, since the constraint is R for register, it will always be in the register. Yes?
It's not going to work because the output is used before the input.
It's not going to work before the output is used before the input. Yes, actually, yes. That is a... It's not quite the answer I had in mind because my reasoning is different, but yes, that's basically the answer. You can't do that because what ends up happening is you're using the output before you're using the input, which is forbidden, as I said. And what happens is that your compiler will be very clever. It will determine that, okay, we could... Actually, I've compiled this. It will determine that we could put out into the EAX register. And then we'll think about, okay, where do we put the in variable? Well, the EAX register looks pretty nice. Because clearly, nobody would ever write that because before he's read the input, right? So what this ends up doing is you write 1 to the EAX register, and then you add the EAX register to itself, I think, and you end up with a value of 2. Interestingly enough, your in variable also won't have changed because that's actually stored in memory. It was just temporarily copied to the EAX register and isn't an out operand, right? So you end up with the value of sort of 3 plus 1 and changing 3, so to speak, being the input is 3 and the output is 2. And it's great when you come across it the first time, and then the 10th time you might remember that there's an ampersand missing right there in line 5. Right. So something else I wanted to talk about real quick, or are there any questions left about GCC? Let's do it like this. Okay. So something else I wanted to talk about is inline assembly, sort of, in LLVM IR. And on some level, this is much less interesting because none of you will ever write LLVM IR by hand, or at least none of you that are not writing compiler tests for LLVM, to be fair. usually compilers will generate this, and the purpose this exists is actually to implement a GCC-like assembly. The reason I wanted to be looking at it is because this is also what we would use in the first place, at least, to implement inline assembly in Rust, right? So doing something that cannot be expressed in LVM inline assembly would be bad. We don't want it to be able to be only expressed in LVM inline assembly, but at least we want something that can be expressed in it. So since it's used to implement GCC style assembly, it's pretty similar to GCC style assembly. It has a template, it has constraints, but inputs and outputs are a bit different syntactically. Like all outputs are return values from a call to the inline assembly, so to speak, and all inputs are just arguments. And the constraints are specified completely separately from both, just in one long string. It also has different placeholders. It uses dollar sign number. It doesn't have named parameters, which is fine for something that is not meant to be written by humans, I guess. It has, similar to GCC, it supports those modifiers. Again, the syntax is a bit different. It's dollar sign, and then in curly braces, you have the number, a colon, and then the modifier you want to specify. And the escape for that is just, again, doubling the character, so dollar sign, dollar sign. Constraints are, interestingly enough, or at least the documentation for them reads a bit different than the one for GCC. I can't, for the love of God, tell if they're actually different or if in the end that ends up being the same thing on some level. So they have a lot of single letter constraint codes, and those definitely are one-to-one mappings to what GCC does. At least I'm pretty sure about that. Then there is also like a circumflex followed by two letters as a constraint code. And names of registers, you can always use just verbatim, the name of the registers, in curly braces. Again, the codes are architecture specific, very much in the same way as they are for GCC. Still, RM and I are pretty much available across all different architectures. Again, you can specify multiple alternative constraints, again, just like in GCC. And then there's something that's not available in GCC, but I think used occasionally to implement some of GCC's output mode, which is an indirect output, where you basically add a star modifier, which tells you, OK, don't give me a memory operand, but give me a register operand that contains the address of that memory. So the difference being one thing actually gives you an address, however that's written in your assembly language, and the other thing gives you a register containing that address. So further for constraints, outputs are also a bit simplified. There is no plus for input and output at the same time. That's just emulated with the tying of inputs to outputs that we've seen before in GCC. So there's no real reasons to implement them in your inline assembly, at least if you're a backend. You still have that funny ampersand character to say this is an early clubber. This is written before all inputs are read, right? And for the inputs, you can still tie them to outputs, saying, OK, this input gets the same register as this output gets. Clubbers are a bit different too because everything is in one long string and it's not separated with colons as is in GCC. Clubbers are determined by seeing if this is a string that starts with a tilde. So basically outputs are equal signs, clubbers are tilde, and everything else is an input. Okay, so what does that look like? Granted, that's actually unoptimized code, so that's on some level more complicated than it needed to be, but at least it shows sort of the operations you would expect. So this first line just allocates memory for a 32-bit integer with an alignment of 4 and calls that person sign 1. So LVM, if you don't know about LVM intermediate representation, it basically models a computer with infinitely many registers. And those registers are just numbered as percent and then some number. And you can't change registers ever. So for each new value, you use a new register, also called static single assignment form, at least a variant thereof. So register, let's call it 1, gets the address of an allocation of a 32-bit integer. And then a second line stores 0 to that integer. The third line loads that integer again. And the loaded value then gets passed to our ASM. And the ASM is basically just the template you've seen before. In this case, we have to escape the dollar signs for the immediate instead of the percents for the registers. So choose your poison, I guess. And then the specification back here is just, OK, we have an input and output, so an output which is a register and an input which is tied to the first output by a number. Your argument is register 2, so the value you've loaded from the allocation, aka 0, which is what we stored in there, just the line before that. So obviously, this load and store could be optimized out, right? But it isn't because it's unoptimized code. And then the return value from that call to our inline assembly will be what's in $0, basically, so the result of our assembly execution. And then we store back that result to the memory, so to the variable. Might actually answer another question, because this is in some way what a compiler generates around the assembly statements in terms of loading a variable to a register and storing it back to memory. Similarly, getting the L1 cache size. You have just two variable allocations, so two 32-bit integers. And then you call into this inline assembly expression without any arguments, because we never had inputs for that, right? We only have outputs. We only want to get the values of EBX and ECX out of there. And the way LVM does that is basically it returns a two-tuple of two 32-bit integers. And then our constraints are basically, OK, you have one output that is in register, you have one output that comes from ECX, and you're clobbering EAX, EBX, and EDX. And assembly is, while probably as readable, exactly the same as we always had before. And following after that is basically just getting the first and the second part of that tuple in lines 6 and 7, and then storing those parts it got from this tuple back to the variables we had. Questions about that?
So in a way, the LLVM variant and the GCC variant allows you to tell the compiler that he can, at least to some extent, allocate registers for you, which, as I saw from your presentation, wasn't possible in the first two variants that you showed. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. So you tell it that a certain operation accesses a variable, right? And then in the end, what it ends up doing is it gives the compiler complete freedom in terms of how it accesses that variable. So if you have a move instruction and you're saying, OK, move something to this variable, move is like super complex in terms of what operands it supports. It could be a memory operand, could be a register, it could be whatever. So basically, the decompiler has to know what operands can go there, and then it will freely choose whatever fits it best. So you can say, OK, definitely give me a register for that variable and move to that variable via the register, which you could argue is bad. But on the other hand, you give the compiler the freedom to access the variable in any way you want. So if it thinks, OK, I already have few registers, and a lot of things access those registers, but the inline assembly is just executed once, it could choose to just write to the memory, because that memory write is only done once anyway. So why clean up a register for that or something? While in GCC inline assembly would generally tend to just say, OK, yeah, put it in a register and then write it to memory if you need to. As in, I've seen very few people actually specify the full list of possible constraints when an instruction would support different operand types. You tend to just say, OK, yeah, this works with a register, let's use a register.
But in the deassembly, you explicitly wrote register names, so that the compiler can't do anything. Well, it could be if it really knows about all the side effects and all.
So I don't, like in theory, they could actually which, if that's the point you're making, they could exchange registers that you have explicitly specified, but I don't think they do. But that's pretty much the same thing that also happens in GCC assembly. Like, you see that I'm explicitly clear setting EAX here, explicitly clearing ECX, and those will always be ECX. And also it actually becomes a bit difficult to tell the compiler, okay, just give me a register that you think is appropriate. Because for that to work, you also have to tell it what variable will back that register. And sometimes you don't actually want a variable to back that register, right? You just want scratch space, so to speak. Anything else? Yeah. So we've heard about different languages and what they do. So let's talk about what Rust does now. And actually, let's talk about something that Rust doesn't do right now. So there is one RFC that has been accepted for assembly and could actually, like in theory, be stabilized. So it's treated as very experimental. And that's global ASM. And what is accepted, it's not even implemented. But the idea is that what that would do is not exactly inline assembly, but something that LLVM calls module level inline assembly. So basically, you just write a bunch of assembly into this global ASM macro at global scope. And the assembled version of that will end up in your executable. So you could write pretty much arbitrary functions with that in assembly and then later call into them. But they are not in any way in line in your existing functions. It's just separate code that will also be in your object. Could also be used to define data or whatever if you actually wanted to. Whatever basically a system assembler supports. And then actual inline assembler in Rust, as I said, it's right now only available nightly. There it's behind the ASM future gate. And it's a macro. And it looks pretty much like what GCC does. Like you get those template strings and you need to specify outputs, inputs, and clubbers. You can also specify options. That option list is, actually a bit strange if you ask me. So you can say it's volatile, which does exactly the same thing as it does in GCC. Disables code motion and disables dead code elimination. You can tell it to align the stack. So your assembly will end up at some aligned address for no specific alignment that you could actually specify, but just something that seems sensible for the architecture, so to speak. And you can say that it's actually Intel assembly and not AT&T assembly. And except for volatile, that's actually the very same modifiers that the LLVM IRI inline assembly instruction supports. So this is a very, very straight mapping to that, including the fact that it uses dollar sign for placeholders instead of the percent sign. But it does, like GCC, support the plus modifier instead of the equals modifier for outputs. So what does it look like if you use it? Pretty much like the brainchild of using LLVM syntax for inline assembly with GCC syntax for inline assembly. So very much in the same way, you have this add with double dollar sign as an LLVM to specify the immediate. But then you have a plus sign on the register to specify this as an input and output, as it was in GCC. Similarly, getting the L1 cache also looks pretty much exactly as it looked in GCC, except the specification for reading from the ECX register is not a single C, but in curly braces ECX, which is a specification that comes straight from LLVM. So this is in some ways a very direct mapping to what LLVM internally provides you, masked as what's familiar from GCC, so to speak. Any questions about that?
EVX and ECX are not mutable in that case. Is that a problem or is it irrelevant?
That's, let's say it's a problem, because that was certainly intended to be the case. On the other hand, I did actually run that through a compiler and it gave me the correct answer. So yeah, inline assembly is not in an unsafe block for no reason, let's say. So apparently, and I did not quite realize that you can specify immutable variables as output operands. That may or may not be a bug that's already reported, or intentional, because we have things like interior mutability after all. Yeah. Anything else? Cool. So Rust future, like this is, let's say, a bit strange. Like it's mapping very straight from LLVM to your front end language. It still has all of the, let's say, bad things that GCC has or annoying things. What would be actually sensible to do? Very early on in Rust's life, or at least in the life of the RFC process, there was a proposal for a different assembly syntax, which was still, so it's still the template approach, right? With very different syntax. Well, not very, but different syntax. So it would first give you the assembly template and then split up the rest of the parameters into first come all positional parameters, then come all name parameters, and then come clubbers and options sort of piled together. Because by what the string actually is, you can differentiate whether it's a clubber or an option. And what was specified back then was this bit idiosyncratic syntax of you can write an expression and that will be treated as an input. You can write an expression and then an arrow and then an expression, and this will treat it as an input and an output, which go into the same place, right? And then only for positional parameters, I guess because the assumption is that those won't actually ever be used explicitly, you can provide a string that is a constraint. So you can say, this variable, please write it to EAX. Some instruction will use it, but I won't explicitly ever mention EAX in the code, possibly. And it will become apparent in the next slide why that's necessary in this case. Then for named parameters, you can't specify constraints explicitly, but you can name the parameters. Otherwise, the syntax is pretty much the same, but you can access it by name instead of just by position. And then your usual clubbers and options. So just an example of what that looks like. What was decided there was the format syntax that we have in Rust is not that bad, actually. Like we have those curly braces, and we can specify a name in there. We can specify a positional number in there. And after a colon, we can specify some modifiers if we need to. So the specification there said that basically you can use an operand multiple times with different constraints, and the constraints go in your placeholder instead of on the operand. And that's exactly what this code does. It returns once the addition of A and B and then the subtraction of A and B. So it uses B both times for both the add and the sub instruction in a register. And then it uses also A, but in two different registers, one that is also tied to C as an output and one that's also tied to D as an output. So it adds B to A and writes that back to C, and then it subtracts B from A and writes that back to D. From a personal vantage point, I find this seems like strange, but that might be because I'm not used to it. Also, it's super underspecified what that's supposed to do in terms of constraints. Because I could argue that this is actually wrong. Because clearly, the first operand is something that's read from A and written to C. So it can't be a pure output operand, right? But it also is not really the plus instead of the equal sign, because it's not written and read from the same variable. And at any rate, there is no input for the A variable as a constraint anywhere. So while I think it's pretty conceivable that you could map that to LLVMIR, the details of that seem super unspecified to me. Also, it seems a bit unnecessary to me that you would have syntax in the operands to say, OK, A is an input and the output is C, and then still specify in the constraint that something is an output. But that's me. So that's one possible future. That ticket was closed a long time ago. People said, noticeably that was probably before 1.0, people said we should experiment with that in separate crates, possibly compiler plugins, but you could also just map from any syntax that you think would be decent to Rust's current inline assembly syntax, right? And that's still what we probably have to do, but the question is, do we want something like this or something completely different? So some questions, and I actually like to, before telling you my own opinion on them, like to pose those to you first. Like, which route is actually better? Should we go down the DSL route that D and MSVC did, or should we go down a template route? And the trade-off is pretty obviously, if you do a DSL, you're writing an assembler. And you're writing an assembler for each and every architecture that you support. Whereas if you do the template route, you get all those strange things about having to carefully specify clubbers and all that stuff, and being sure you carefully specify what is an early clubber, what is not. Then does it maybe make sense to support both, like in cases where DSL was not yet written, have a fallback to a template kind of thing? What does one do about early clubbers? Like something you could, for example, do about them is just say everything is an early clubber. Like it's perfectly legal to write outputs before inputs. That just means you have to allocate more registers, possibly. What's a decent placeholder? Like is dollar sign or percent sign good, or should we use what Rust currently uses everywhere else? That might be a suggestive question, but I don't know. Is it maybe most sensible to just do whatever GCC does, not in the sort of mixed with RVM way that we have right now, but like literally what GCC does? Because that's familiar. You can look that up on like the YASDEF wiki, copy it, should work, right? Our constraints is just single characters that might sometimes not be memorable, actually a sensible thing to do. Should we maybe like have a mapping from, we call it rec and not R, and hardcode that in a compiler? Again, that would mean hardcoding that in the compiler per architecture, because those constraints are architecture specific. But also they're probably backend specific, so that might be sensible anyway. And also, are all those signals sensible? Like having equal signs, plus signs, ampersands, tildes, do you want to write those? Do you want something else? What would be something else? Like that are sort of the design questions I'm asking myself there. And I'm happy to hear your opinions on any of them, actually. Yes?
There was a discussion about creating a new language in the context of having short or long identifiers. I think there was a discussion actually about Rust and how in the beginning there was a consensus to use longer identifiers. For example, the try macro turned into a single character question mark.
Mm.
And if, I believe if Rust is trying to invent its own DSL or not copy anyone, then at least in the beginning, the schedule heavy constraints are not the right way to go, because they're more difficult to learn. For example, when you were explaining the LLVM, no, when you were explaining the Rust RFC for inline assembly, it was quite difficult to catch up with all the schedules and all the specifiers because of the novelty of that. So,
yeah.
I think that's it's either copying GCC or something similar, or use the schedule-heavy constraints. These are two things that are kind of exclusive, mutually exclusive. So I believe that from the sense of familiarity, it's easier to use GCC syntax, or otherwise you're going to have a very verbose thing to start with, because otherwise people are not going to use it.
Right. So, trying to summarize it for the recording, you're basically saying, so for familiarity, certainly GCC, but if you're not doing something familiar, do something sufficiently verbose so that people will actually have to like write a lot, but it will be very clear what it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, are there any significant benefits from not going the GCC route? Or, I mean, what, are there any like, significant benefits in taking the other approach?
The other approach, meaning the DSL approach, or?
Let's talk about sigil-heavy constraints, for instance. Are there any significant benefits other than like this looks like this or this looks like this? I mean,
so sigil-heavy constraints is actually something. So the question is, are there benefits to any of them? So sigil-heavy constraints is actually something that I'm calling what GCC has, right? Because they have all those sigils, like they have equal sign, plus sign, ampersand in their constraints.
Right.
So this is not like equivalent to character-heavy, but like you have symbols sort of that speak for a lot of what they do. Which is also like, to put that back to that discussion of what Rust originally did. Rust originally had a allocate this on the heap operator, which was a tilde. Right now, we don't even have an operator for that anymore. Like the operator for that is called box colon colon new parenthesis. So personally, I super want to get that box operator, but different discussion. So Rust certainly has been moving away from sigils anyway. The question is if familiarity is not something that far beats that. Other comments? So, okay, let's be a bit more provocative. So, something that we definitely saw is that D and MSVC are like super easy to write, right? Like, at least to me personally, I could write that preparing for this talk and be reasonably sure that I did not mess up. And I've certainly never felt that way with GCC style templates, right? And that's sort of also something that Rust wants to get you. Like, you write code and you're sure that it's correct. What would be your argument that we don't write in the DSL? Because that's clearly easier to use, at the very least.
Just to be sure about the DSL is a totally new defined language for this purpose, and the templates are the string patterns that are replaced
by
the registers.
DSL might not necessarily technically be the correct term, but DSL like is what I'm calling what D and MSVC do. Like basically redefining what D and MSVC do is what I'm calling DSL like. Or a DSL. You could also call it custom assembler or whatever, right? And template like is what I'm calling the GCC and LVM approach. Mm-hmm.
So I totally vote for the DSL approach. And I think familiarity isn't a strong reason to copy the GCC. Maybe there are other reasons, but familiarity wasn't a reason for Rust to adopt several things. And Rust has chosen a lot of things just because they're good, collected good things from other languages. And familiarity was the second choice on this. And I think assembly should go the same way. Also.
Okay.
So one argument that goes against DSL is support for instructions that are going to appear later or some sort of CPU-specific instructions that are not present in the release of the language that you are actually using right now. I don't know how it works with languages which are constantly development, but I imagine that in some situations you are stuck with a single version and your hardware moves on.
In assembly, you normally have the opportunity to insert plain raw bytes just to express instructions that aren't covered by the assembly language itself or are too new to be covered by the language. But you somehow have to declare the side effects this this instruction would have. But if you have a notation for the clobbering in and out, I don't think that's a big obstacle to support generic or new assembly instructions that aren't known yet. Or use some internals of the CPU that aren't exposed by the assembly at all.
Right, so something I should possibly mention at that point is that MSVC actually has an emit pseudo instruction which will let you emit raw bytes. But something that I at least think would become increasingly difficult is sort of using raw bytes to emit an instruction, but then mix that with possibly even giving the compiler freedom to use a certain register or telling the compiler explicitly to use this in that register. Because at that point, what you're doing on some level is you're having everything that you have to do in GCC plus more because you can't use your system assembler anymore. And you have written a DSL.
It's definitely a workaround, but it's no longer a blocker if you have the possibility to do so.
Right. So you get a very clunky escape edge, let's say. Yeah, definitely. Okay. So just so we can finish up, we can certainly talk later in person if you want to. My thoughts are, I'm personally a fan of templates. Not just because of newer instructions, but I think that it's generally more sensible for portability across platforms. Because I don't see us writing basically our own assembler for, Rust is probably right now at like supporting 4 or 5 different architectures, and having all of them in tree and doing that again and again seems a lot of work, and a lot of work that nobody would necessarily want to do. Also not work that someone would necessarily want to do when porting to a new architecture. On the other hand, I'm not sure if that's a fair claim. Like, you could possibly generate those assemblers from like LVM's description of instructions or something like that. Maybe that would be an option. But my feeling is that templates are good, like to me personally, in terms of I'm accessing the system assembler via that, and whenever that changes, I get access to that. Another counterpoint to like counter myself a bit is what I've said in the very beginning. You always have to be able to use to specify your operands properly in the template model. So if you have a new instruction and it uses a completely new register class, and your compiler can't assign values to that register class at all because it doesn't know it exists, that's not helpful to you. Best thing you could do, but you could still do that, is mention the register explicitly in the assembly, and then do moves from memory also in the assembly. Catch with that is, once your compiler catches up, it might use those very same registers itself and declubber them without specifying a clubber because that clubber was not yet available to you. You get very many different ways to shoot yourself on the foot, so. So other thing, placeholder, I think for that, I would definitely argue that familiarity from GCC is not a big argument. Like, if we're doing templates, we're probably doing templates with format string like syntax as it's used in println or anywhere else. Like, the thing to keep in mind here is basically how annoying, like, to me, is this for the assembly programmer. And for some reason, dollar sign and percent sign actually turn out to be super annoying for the assembly programmer, even though they chose to use them for inline assembly. Like, that's all over the place in AT&T Intel syntax. Like, that's literally every line has one of them, at least one of them, one or the other. Whereas curly braces are relatively rare. ARM assembly has them. ARM assembly has them for register sets. And I wouldn't say that register sets are uncommon. Like, on average, you find some of them in each function. But they're used for things like write back 2 registers from the stack where you saved them and write back to the program counter at the same time to do a return. For some reason, that's available in RISC architecture, I don't know. But it doesn't occur very often. And I wouldn't say it, I would claim that it probably occurs even less in inline assembly. Like compilers like to generate them because it allows them to do a lot in one instruction, but it's not something that should come up all too often in inline assembly. And it's not like you can't at all type those characters just because we use them as placeholders. You can still double them up and that will be the escape. I also think sigils are annoying because you have to remember them. Inline assembly is, even as a systems guy, inline assembly is not something that you super commonly do. In many projects, you write, have to write some, you write it once, hide it behind a macro or whatever, never look at it until it breaks or something like that. So I've met people who I know are super familiar with that stuff, but still have forgotten some of the details about it. Also, I think it would be sensible to like be able to intermix input and outputs operands in any order, which makes it easier to do positional access to them from instructions. Like GCC currently, you have to specify all outputs and then all inputs, and then access them by number or by name, where by name, of course, is pretty decent still, but it would be nice to be able to do them in any order and then just write curly braces since they get read in that order. And then early Clubber, I think that's pretty much one of the things that bites most people who first write inline assembly. I think it could be an option to do it by default, though my suspicion is that at least on platforms with few registers, that's not really an option for performance because it clubbers a lot of, well, clubbers, so to speak. Like it assigns a lot of registers that can no longer be used as inputs at the same time. If we can't do early clubber for whatever reasons by default, I think we should probably at least be explicit. Like, don't do something like, okay, you have to add an ampersand for this to be early clubber. Make people make this choice explicitly. For example, something that Rust right now does for raw pointers is they are not like shared pointers in the sense that you have mut or nothing. You have to have mut or const. Constantly reminding people that this is a choice. This is either constant or this is mutable. Specifically because you could pass a const pointer somewhere and still mutate it, since this is completely unsafe code. So you make that source very explicit to them that this is, okay, this is const. It's not mutable because this looks like your C pointer or something, right? And then pretty much in the same way, I think it could be sensible to say, okay, we have early outs and late outs. So you always get to the choice, is this something that's pre-input or post-input? This is something that I came up actually a while back, and I have no idea if that's at all sensible or whatever. But this would be my imagined syntax for doing something in terms of inline assembly. So it's a template, and it's more wordy, right? You have the curly braces as a placeholder. You say, okay, I have an input and output at the same time. So this thing could also be just in or just out. Maybe it should be in, late, out, or whatever, which makes this super wordy and super annoying to type, but whatever. You get a constraint in parentheses. Let's say it's reg. Maybe it should be register because Rust tends towards full words. But I'd say this is something that actually is sensible to write per architecture, have a mapping from words to one-letter constraint specifiers. Just because it makes things a lot more readable and a lot more rememberable. And then lastly, you specify what variable goes with that operand. Same thing for the L1 cache variant. You'd say out and then say, okay, this is any register and it's written to the EBX variable. You say out and say this is red actually because it's an output. From the ECX register and goes to the ECX variable, and then you have a list of clubbers specified inside a sort of clubber call-ish. And to me personally, that seems like it's a good in-between of being a bit more wordy, but yet reasonably familiar and also reminding people of what things actually do instead of like equals R, equals C, parenthesis, variable name, or something like that. It also very naturally has support for named arguments and that you could just write name equal signs just like you do in regular format strings right now in front of any of those and then refer to them with the name in the curly braces. Similarly, it has the same extension point that LVM gives you with in curly braces put a colon after the number, the name, or the nothing in there and specify a modifier to say this should be a short register or something like that. Pretty much in the same way that we currently specify debug output in print line. Okay, so that's my 20 cents, let's say. A pretty long talk. Thank you for listening for that long time. I'm happy to still answer any remaining questions. Slides will be available at that address. They are not yet. But yeah.
You have shown two variants of the new assembly from you, and in the one you used curly braces for the placeholder, and in the other one a dollar sign. Which one would you actually prefer, or did I understand something wrong?
Yeah, no, let's say that's a typo.
Okay.
No, definitely curly braces. I think that was actually in my what do I think about this list. Like, I think we should go with curly braces just because it's familiar from everywhere else in the language where we have template-y things. So
it looks nice that way.
Right, yeah.
Does the template approach have really no knowledge about the instructions it processes? For example, if there is a move instruction from a register to memory, if the register is given as an input, then the move instruction would need to guess the size of the movement?
So if you have a move instruction and let me think about the question. So you specify in the template approach that something should be in a register, you do a move. Yes, actually, interesting case that I'm also not sure I've wrapped my head around completely. I think generally what it does, at least for x86, it gives you a register in the sense that it gives you that register that has many sub-registers, because on x86 is really only sub-registers of different sizes. And it pretends that the whole thing is written. And also from the point of how it's encoded in the instructions, I think it doesn't usually matter how large it is. Like you get the same encoding no matter what you're reading or writing as part of the register, except for 64-bit. My assumption has always been that there is some magic happening in terms of the variable that you give it. Like if you give it a 32-bit integer, it would end up in a 32-bit register, naturally. And also you're reading from a 32-bit integer register if you're outputting to an integer that size. Though I feel like I'd have to look at more at what it actually generates in the template. Oops. Because I've just today seen something like this assembly, let's do the proper one. This assembly where you say, okay, I want you to read from the C register. If you look at that in the LLVM version, it actually doesn't specify that it wants to read from the ECX register. It says it wants to read from the CX register, which is not technically the same thing, but still works out probably due to instruction encoding. And admittedly, I'd like to understand better how that selection works exactly. I think the most sensible thing is probably from variable size that is specified. But I don't know exactly, actually.
That won't work for the 8-bit variants.
That
won't work for the 8-bit variants as
AHR. Right. That also won't work for 8-bit variants, also because the MOF instruction for 8-bit.
Two registers in the same bank, in the same board. AO and AH are both in the...
Right, so for the high portion of the low 16-bit, that won't work.
Everything else can be specified by bit width.
But also for just moving 8-bit registers, I think there's a specific encoding for MOF which is specific to the 8-bit variant. Yeah. Good questions. I have not looked closely at that, yes, admittedly. Okay, if that's all questions there are right now, then I guess let's move on to the social part of the evening or something like that.